Called it. I'll get it now. Can I tap again? Do you want me to tap this? Okay. Call to order the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. Today is Wednesday, February 11th. We have a couple of public hearings scheduled. We're going to be having a hearing on Senate Bill 209, a public hearing on Senate Bill 261, and a public hearing on Senate Bill 20. And it looks like we're going to be able to go in that order. So I'm going to start out by opening up a public hearing on Senate Bill 209. And we're going to start out with some presentation or some testimony from Matt Morrison from Penoir. So if you could kick us off here, that'd be great.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Matt Morrison, Executive Director of the Pacific Northwest Economic Region. Very happy to be here. I'm going to just do a very quick, I don't know if, do you see this? Or
it's well, not on yet.
A quick presentation. Penoir has been charged by the state of Washington to develop a regional prevention strategy or framework for quagga zebra mussels in the Pacific Northwest. As you may know, they are now in Utah, Nevada, California, Manitoba, and marching toward us. So the Penoir region, which is five states in the Northwest and three provinces, two territories, the only area that's left untouched by these invasives. And we're trying to keep it that way. Our essential, just totaling up the economic impact studies that have been done by Bonneville Power and by Alberta, by a number, by Idaho, we figure that it's a $500 million, $500 million annual cost if we fail to keep these invasives out of the region. The major costs would be to hydropower, fish hatcheries, all water systems, recreation, and especially agriculture, irrigation districts, and industry as well. So there are a lot of people in the region working on this issue, and Oregon's been very, very active, and we're very grateful for that. I think that the great hope we have is that WERDA, the Water Resources and Development Act that passed Congress this past summer, contained in it a section that would authorize $20 million of federal funding annually to the Columbia Basin for prevention and monitoring activities of quagga zebra mussels. This money has not been appropriated, and our first ask is that we support our congressional delegation to try to appropriate that money, and that would be used in partnership with the states in a 50-50 match to enhance our prevention efforts, inspection stations, et cetera. We also are trying to push the federal government to support the mandatory decontamination around federally managed water bodies, especially Lake Mead. That's where most of these things are coming from. You know, the other thing is we would support the reauthorization of the National Invasive Species Act, and also adding the quagga to the zebra mussels. Zebra mussels are already in the Lacey Act, but that would enable our federal officials to stop and inspect boats coming in from Canada. It would also empower interstate travel, especially of the professional marine carriers that carry boats. So basically, in order to do this in 3 minutes, we're trying to, this framework will be done by June, and we'll share it with your committee. Looking at the economic impacts if we fail to keep these out of our region, and what an effective perimeter strategy would look like, and what would it cost. So I'm going to let this one pass. I think that you'll be talking about this today. Just as a means of comment, the number of boats inspected in 2014 was 11,490. There were 11 that were contaminated with these particular critters. There were other things that were found.
Yeah. Can I ask you a question? Right when you're right there at the 11 that were contaminated, do we have a definitive idea where they came from?
I think, yeah, they're right here on the slide. The contaminated boat was, we have a destination and origin on that slide on page 5. Page 5 there. So
thank
some
you.
Lake Superior, Lake Mead, et cetera. And then also in the bottom of page 5, there's some specific incidents that you can see. And our number one thing, we actually would like to share with you, the other four states in the Penwar region have adopted joint resolutions to Congress to appropriate the $20 million that was authorized in the WRDA. And we would like to submit or share with you a draft of a memorial that you may or may not take up. So with that, I just want you to know that your colleagues in Montana and Idaho and in Washington are taking this very seriously, and that we have to work together as a region to try to really make sure that that we have a good strategy, because if not, we'll be paying for it for a long time, as not only with money, but with the environmental quality of our recreational lakes and rivers. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Thank you very much. As a past president of the Oregon Bass Federation,
what's that?
Back here. As a past president of the Oregon Bass Federation, we've been really concerned about invasive species, and one of the problems that we knew about was when Lake Mead was infested. The question I have is I own a bass boat. My bass boat has live wells in there, and there's a piping system and all that. When you do your inspection, how do you make certain that those little boogers aren't hiding in those pipes? Because you can't see through them, and they won't come loose if you flush them. How do you make sure they're not in there?
It's just one of the very difficult things about this whole thing. The other one is wakeboard boats and their ballast tanks. You can't empty them completely.
Mm-hmm.
And they come up from Lake Mead, and that's a real serious problem. So there is a group that is trying to get the boat manufacturers to add features so that you can drain these tanks, or at least put in a chlorine tablet or something to deal with them.
Yeah. Would there be a mesh screen that would be small enough to prevent them from getting in?
I don't believe so.
Okay.
I know that they're the size of your little finger, and they have a million babies a year.
They do.
And they float around.
Follow up. Yeah. If you don't mind. We had some discussion on this a couple years ago, and we talked about, the voluntary check stations and all that along the freeways. One of the questions I asked and was seeing if we could get this put together, and I don't think it has been yet, was that we in the bass fishing community, our boaters travel up and down the West Coast, but they also fish bass tournaments in our states. And we were wondering if there would be a possibility where you could bring a team out to train the people that run the tournament so they could be investigative and look at these boats to make certain prior to the tournament that they can't be put in the water if these mussels are seen.
Great idea.
I mean, because it would be easy for us because it would be volunteer. We actually do a boat check, safety check, before we have tournaments. And in the process of that boat check, we could have a guy look through. We certainly can't look through the pipes and all that stuff, but we could at least look on the outside, on the trailers, in the live wells and all that stuff to see if we could
find that there's a problem and keep that boat off the water, actually take them out of the tournament because of that. And I was wondering if we could possibly put together, or and because I know my people would be more than willing to do this, if we could put together a training so that we could be, not, I don't know if would, the term would be certified, but we could be trained to identify this stuff and be able to have the authority to take a boat out of action. Because in the tournament rules, we can do it, but we just don't have the people that know exactly what they're looking for. And if we could do a course, I know our folks would be more than willing to volunteer, because we do 50, 60 tournaments in this state alone a year. And you, if you look at a tournament, average tournament of 50 boats, that's a lot of boats that are looked at.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know there are other folks here that could probably address this better than I.
Okay.
And Washington and Idaho both have a passport system, and we've talked about making that region-wide so that if your boat is inspected on a certain day and you're passing through a state, that would be noticed by the next state. You'd mm-hmm. have a stamp on it. Anyway, really appreciate, and Oregon has a great program, and we just need to make sure that we're all collaborating and recognizing how serious this thing is to the future of our whole environment. Thank great. You, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Matt. Any other questions?
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Okay.
Next, we'll call up, Gabriella Goldfarb from the governor's office. Oh, and Ryan Hoof.
Yeah.
Even asked you at the time.
Very good afternoon, Chair Edwards, Vice Chair Olson, and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Gabriella Goldfarb, Natural Resources Policy Advisor to the Governor. And this is a very timely presentation we had from Mr. Morrison, because it really illustrated one particularly huge looming invasive species threat. And I'm here to speak with you about Senate Bill 209 regarding the Oregon Invasive Species Council. I'm going to offer just a few brief comments and turn it over to a current Invasive Species Council member and past chair, Ryan Hoof. Who is with DEQ, and he can provide additional detail and answer a lot of the questions that you were raising, Senator Olson. So invasive species are a serious matter for the state. We just heard about wanting to prevent one that's not here, but we have some that are already here. The Oregon Department of Agriculture recently completed a study, an economic impact study, that found that 25 of Oregon's most significant invasive weed species are causing upwards of $83 million a year in losses to the state's economy. Now, that's a sobering number. However, that same study found that if we didn't have a coordinated effort of control and eradication, those damages would be upwards of $1 billion.
I'm sorry, this is an important issue to me. Could you send us those 25 weed species? Because I know milfoil is one of them.
Yes. So and we could send you that economic study, and I think it identifies the weeds and the economic analysis.
Question off the cuff, is marijuana?
Is that an invasive?
That wasn't one of the 25.
He's been smoking too much.
Also,
it's an industrial stuff, man. He's going to have a headache all day.
Okay. We have a great time here.
There you do, indeed. I won't touch that species. So, as Mr. Morrison said, and as is true for the Invasive Species Council in Oregon, coordinated efforts are really essential to prevent the introduction of something new and to respond quickly and effectively and decisively when something shows up, and when we have an ongoing problem like with weeds, to work together to pool resources and strategies. And our council includes state agencies, federal agencies, and private sector members. So it's a pretty broad stakeholder group, as well as academia. The bill before you makes a very small change, but it's significant. The only change that we are seeking in the statute is to make the appointment of a coordinator of the group mandatory rather than discretionary. And the point of that was to signal the importance of this issue to the state, And that importance is mirrored in the governor's requested budget, which seeks to increase funding for the council, for council's activities, from $50,000 to $150,000. So there's $50,000 in the base, and we have a pop for another $100,000. And Ryan, you'll hear from Ryan more about how the funds right now are leveraged. This investment that the state makes is leverages much more funding from other sources. And I'll note in particular that the council's work is going to be supportive of the state SageCon effort. So addressing invasive weeds is one of the primary threats to the sage grouse habitat. And there's another source of funding that's going to go for landowner grants, but we need that coordinating effort of the council working with the SageCon core team and partnership to bring the full array of tools to deal with that and help us in our effort to avoid an endangered species listing. So I want to keep it brief and turn it over to Ryan, who can speak to more aspects of the council and answer competently specific questions that any of you may have about the state of our invasive species in Oregon. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Go ahead, Ryan.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ryan Hoof, and I serve as the Department of Environmental Quality's designated representative to the Invasive Species Council. Thank you for this opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 209. The Council's mission is to protect Oregon's economy and natural resources by conducting a coordinated and thorough effort to keep invasive species out of our state, and also to eliminate, reduce, or mitigate the potential for impacts of invasive species once they do become established in our state. First and foremost, we believe that prevention is the most critical and paramount activity to the health of Oregon's ecosystems, economy, and quality of life. This really requires that we minimize the transport of invasive species into our state by the various pathways that they can get here. But those pathways can also be controlled by people. These pathways include vehicles, planes, boats of all sizes, and so forth. In general, depending on the species or habitat type, a variety of case studies have found that for every dollar that's spent on prevention efforts, we are saving $20 to $40 in the control costs that we face once those species become established in our state. The OISC helps to leverage our member agencies in the state and stakeholder relationships to achieve early detection of invasions and then carry out quick and coordinated responses to help control and hopefully eradicate and prevent their establishment of new species before they become either technically or financially impossible to control. Coordination amongst the state's natural resource agencies and key stakeholders is a primary function of the council and a critical component of our state's preparedness. In recent years, the coordinator position has resulted in a great return on investment for the state. Between 2009 and 2014, while the state was contributing roughly $50,000 per biennium to support the coordinator, the council's grant development efforts and ability to leverage funds from other sources resulted in about $300,000 per biennium in additional funds to help support invasive species education, outreach efforts, and other coordination efforts specifically here in our state. However, stable backing to fund the coordinator has challenged the council's ability to attract and maintain or keep qualified candidates in that role. In addition to elevating the importance of the coordinator position, this bill also clarifies the voting rights status of the 10 appointed members of the council. The existing statute was unclear on this point, and the council supports the bill as it has been introduced because it aligns with the council's mission and goals and validates our current operating practices. So thank you again for the opportunity to testify. I'd be happy to answer any specific questions you might have.
Ryan, what were the and I don't know if you have the information right away, but you said the state investment helped the council additionally secure over $300,000, I think, in other funds, sources of other funds. Are those federal grants? Are they private nonprofits? Like, could you just give me a flavor of?
Yeah, sure. Just to the general idea, some of it was donations from our federal partners. BLM and Forest Service have been great contributors to the council's activities. Some of them were specific grants for projects, such as supporting a coordinated mapping, online mapping tool, so we can keep track of new detections called IMAP invasives to help support the development and maintenance of that project. And then some of the other projects, one of the large ones was a outreach and education effort. It was actually multi-state, but Oregon really helped spearhead that effort related to concerns about firewood use and people transporting firewood around and into the region as a vector of forest pests. So that's just a general flavor of the types of projects for which the council was receiving funds while having a very strong coordinator presence.
Right. Okay. Thank you. Any other questions?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, thank you very much. We're dealing with the zebra mussels, quagga mussels. I noticed here we had two boats that were intercepted coming from the Great Lakes and Lake Erie. One headed to Brownlee and one headed to Columbia River. Oftentimes, ocean-going vessels traverse the Great Lakes and they could come into the Columbia River. There's no absolute positive way we could ever stop that, is there?
Well, we do have our ballast water management program for ocean-going commercial vessels, which is the subject of a bill that's going to be on your agenda here shortly. But we do refer to that in the discussion about zebra and quagga mussels as being sort of a very strong potential backdoor pathway. A lot of the focus has indeed been on recreational boats being trailered overland from one water body to the next. But commercial vessels indeed were the source of zebra mussels coming to North America and being introduced into the Great Lakes. And it's very much part of our program to focus on management strategies that would prohibit and prevent any ballast water being transported or even biofouling on vessels being transported into our waters that could bring that particular species into the Columbia River, for example. Our program is much more focused and situated around ballast water management and not so much on biofouling, which is the way critters can attach to the hull and superstructure. We don't have specific management practices identified for commercial vessels in that regard, but having traversed through the middle of the ocean, the salinity level would hopefully be significant enough to kill off any freshwater species during their transit before they come into our state waters.
Also, we should also, and I assume we are looking at weed infestation from different bodies of water that could come in here and impact us. Do we have are either of our universities working on mitigation of weeds? I mean, because another weed that comes to mind, or it's not a weed, it's a plant that we've actually sold here, is ivy. Mm-hmm. And that's an invasive species, and it takes off, and it just gets on everything. Do we have our universities working on ways to mitigate the problem? Or, you know, I know zebra mussels are extremely difficult to get rid of. Are you following research on the way to kill these species?
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, indeed, the research that's happening from various universities, including Portland State University Center for Lakes and Reservoirs, but also through education and outreach efforts, is being a primary tool that Oregon State University Sea Grant Program has been involved in, are really targeting recreational boats in terms of their movement, but also on the research side, looking at the monitoring, keeping track so that we can have early detection before they get here. But in terms of prevention in the first place and mitigating their introduction to state waters in the first place, the state's Marine Board and Department of Fish and Wildlife's inspection program isn't just focused on zebra and quagga mussels. It's taking the opportunity to look for recreational boats that could be dirty by any mechanism. So if there are weeds or any other types of material that could be transported into our state, they're using that as an opportunity to decontaminate and deal with those vessels.
Follow?
Yeah.
Boats are a really easy target on the freeways to get, and some of the major highways that come up the back way. Do we, because when you go to California, you cross the border, they say, do you have any fruits or vegetables or anything like that? We don't do that. Seems to me there are a tremendous possibility of transporting vegetation that we don't want, that's not native to here, and we don't seem to be able to ask about it. Has there been any thought about an agricultural checkpoint?
You know, I don't have the numbers for you offhand right now, but there has been discussions about the value of that type of a program, like you mentioned California has. That truly would be a mechanism to address a wide variety of species of concern, not just those that can be transported on recreational boats that we're currently only targeting, is during certain times of the year and certain times of the day and on certain highways. Certainly a checkpoint station, more formalized, would provide an opportunity to even tighten down our ability to prevent things even more than we've been able to do thus far.
And my last question, follow-up, as I mentioned earlier, our bass clubs, you know, we have the opportunity to look at a lot of boats. Would I contact you, or would we write legislation? Would I talk to you about it, or write legislation to allow different groups that use boats to have an opportunity to learn about it and be able to examine the boats so that we can be kind of like a volunteer group to help you guys? Because there's not a lot of you and there's a lot of us.
Right.
Sure. How would we go about that? Would you know?
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, I don't have a specific answer on legislation that would be required for that, but I can say that there are models for that type of activity by other groups that have been deployed elsewhere. Certainly locally up in Lake Whatcom County in Washington, they've instituted a local volunteer-based program, and in some other areas they've done that as well. In terms of the enforcement capabilities, I can't speak to that specifically. That would be something that we'd have to discuss in more detail. But I do know that lots of groups like the one that you're a part of and have mentioned have been very important players in spreading the word and taking actions in terms of inspection at specific events to mitigate any risks.
I'd like to talk to you at a later date if I could.
Great. I'd love to. Thank you.
Ryan, I forgot my question. Any other questions? Mm-hmm. I had another question for you. I'll think of it in a minute.
You want me to ask a question?
I was thinking about all the things that you were talking about, and I was enthused by your enthusiasm, and I forgot what I was gonna ask.
Don't encourage him.
Well, never mind.
We can call Ryan back later.
No, oh, I remember what I was going to ask. Could you describe the amount of effort to rid a body of water should zebra or quagga mussels get into said lake? Then what happens then?
Yeah.
I mean, is all hope lost and you just, you know, ruin the ecosystem, or can you slowly, over time, recover with millions and millions of dollars spent?
Right. Well, Chair Edwards, excellent question. And indeed, we do focus on prevention for a reason, because certainly in an aquatic habitat, the possibilities for eradication decrease rapidly over time. After prevention, our focus is on early detection. If you can detect these things early and get after it, you're going to have much greater chance of being able to do something to control its spread and perhaps even perform some eradication types of actions. The region has really been working together, not just within the state but in other states, to try to identify what the regulatory and permitting issues would be for establishing a rapid response to something like a zebra and quagga mussel infestation, if it were in the right conditions, say a slow-moving water body, and all the pieces were in place. We do believe that there are actions we could take to hopefully rid our waters of them before they had spread rapidly, under the right circumstances. But that requires coordination and requires lots of upfront work with our various state agencies on shared water bodies, with our federal partners, to identify what the barriers are to being able to do that rapidly.
Mm. Thank you.
I have a question along that line then.
Yeah.
The zebra mussel, quagga mussel, are they sex specific? Do you have to have two? Just one?
You have to have two.
You have to have two.
Yes, but they're referred to as broadcast spawners, so mm-hmm. their gametes are in the water column. They don't actually.
So, for example, mate. If it got in the Celilo pool on the Columbia, it'd be nigh unto impossible to get rid of them, wouldn't it?
It'd be very difficult.
Yeah. We got to prevent them.
Great. Seeing no other questions, thank you both for your testimony.
Thank you.
Next, we'll call up Tom Wolf. And we are still on Senate Bill 209, folks.
Senator Edwards, committee members, For the record, my name is Tom Wolf, the Executive Director of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited, and I will be very brief. In 2009, Trout Unlimited worked very hard to help pass the law that would create the Invasive Species Check Station, Invasive Species, and other bills that session. I think we helped pass 13 that dealt with that. And in 2011, we helped pass a bill that made the stopping at the check stations mandatory. So for us, this is a very important issue. Invasive species is the great unknown, people realize it's there, but it doesn't get the publicity that other things do that are causing environmental harm. Climate change, lack of water, water pollution, those things do. But studies show that when there's an introduction of invasive species into a habitat that's impaired, whether it's temperature or lack of shade or whatever, it can be the killer of native species. You know, if we speak specifically of zebra mussels or quagga mussels, once they get in the system and they grow at the rate that was talked about, where they could produce about 1 million eggs, they pretty much infest the stream in a short time. Once they do, they drive out the macroinvertebrates. They make it impossible for the native fish to feed. They clog up hydro systems there. Right now, billions of dollars across the country are being spent to stop that. And making an invasive species council coordinator mandatory doesn't seem like a big step in that, but having a very dynamic invasive species council that will help work on this issue, other issues, is a very important part in the battle we have to carry forth to stop invasive species and deal with this very real and present problem. So we ask that you support this bill, because we think is a good step in the right directions for a problem that frankly makes me sit up at night and not sleep, because I worry about it. So I urge you to vote yes on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Any questions?
I have one for Tom. Okay. Tom, would your group be willing to work with the Oregon Bass Federation and other fishing groups?
Absolutely.
To put together what I've talked about?
I was thinking that when you were talking about it. I think it's a great idea. I have a really good relationship with various people in your group. I'd be absolutely happy for our group to work with yours and others.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Tom.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Is there anybody else that hasn't signed up that would like to testify in the public hearing on Senate Bill 209? Okay, then we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 209, and we are going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 261. And let's see, signed up for Senate Bill 261, we've got Ryan again and Palmer Mason.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, Palmer Mason, I'm the legislative coordinator for the Department of Environmental Quality. We're here today to explain to you Senate Bill 261 and to urge your support of the bill. Ryan, as you probably saw from the last discussion, is the expert on all things ballast water, so direct your questions to him, please.
Thanks. I'll try to keep this brief. For the record, my name is Ryan Hoof from the Department of Environmental Quality. Chair Edwards, members of the committee, as the Ballast Water Program Coordinator for the state, I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 261. This bill establishes an industry-supported fee increase that would help maintain DEQ's ballast water program activities at current service levels beyond 2015. Currently, DEQ implements a 1.5 FTE program focused on preventing the economic and environmental threats posed by aquatic invasive species that can be introduced through our waterways from incidental commercial vessel shipping activities. Program activities have been supported since 2012 by a 50-50 cost share between general fund allocations and the ballast water management fee that's assessed on commercial vessels as they enter state waters. The fee was established in statute during the 2011 legislature at $70 per arrival and has not been increased since. The proposed increase to $88 per arrival was developed with consensus support from members of the Task Force on Shipping Transport of Aquatic Invasive Species. Balanced water management program activities at DEQ that rely on fee revenue are rooted in prevention and include monitoring incoming vessel traffic for pre-arrival ballast reporting compliance, screening those reports for discharge activity and regulatory compliance, inspecting high-risk vessels and sampling ballast tanks for compliance verification, carrying out enforcement actions as necessary, developing and coordinating policies with our neighboring states to ensure consistency, and providing outreach and technical assistance to vessel operators. Without a fee increase and a commensurate increase in general fund allocation, program activities would be reduced later this year from 1.5 to about 1.2 FTE. The direct result would be a decline in our vessel inspection and compliance verification rate from over 15% of vessels inspected to less than 4% of vessels inspected. In addition, we would have reduced capacity for interagency coordination, for outreach efforts, and for providing technical assistance to the maritime industry. In conclusion, the stakeholder supported fee increase in association with DEQ Policy Option Package 136 will maintain ongoing efforts to prevent aquatic invasive species introductions that otherwise would result in detrimental economic and or ecological consequences to our state. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of this bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, let's see. I was on this committee when we initiated the fee.
That's right.
And it was only 2 years ago, kind of.
2011.
Yeah.
You said 2012.
That's well. I'm
that's
sorry.
That's when it started. Yeah. So it's been in effect for 2 years. Now.
Chair Edwards and Senator Thompson, the legislation was passed in 2011. The fee implementation began January of 2012.
Okay. Correct. So it's run 2 full years. So what's that? 20% increase in 2 years. So 10% a year.
Correct.
So have employee costs gone up 10% a year?
I can't speak exactly at this moment in time on the specifics of the employee costs per se. Some of this has to do with vessel arrival numbers, but it, indeed, the just general increase of cost of business is the primary driver of this fee increase need.
Okay, thank you.
And you said, could you repeat the numbers? You currently, did you say inspect 12%?
Our numbers for 2013 and 2014 were over 15%.
Over 15%. Yeah. Okay. And you project that you would have the capacity for 4%.
Chair Edwards, that's correct. It would be less than about 3.5 to 4% is what we were able to achieve before
percentage,
we had the
because,
additional
because
half
the numbers are going up. So the percentage would be going down. But
the percent of vessels per year that enter state waters that receive an inspection by our program is what would be decreased. So,
yeah. As a follow-up, could you give me that what I asked for? Why is the where'd you get the 20% increase? Why is it costing that much more?
Chair Edwards, Senator Thompson, we can provide that definitely information. Yes.
Yeah, Senator Olson.
I'm sorry, Senator Thompson. Is this enough? In 2011, I argued the fact that $70 wasn't enough to inspect what we had to inspect. And I can understand Senator Thompson's concern of the increase. Apparently, from 2012 to now, we've learned that it wasn't enough money and we should have probably started higher. The concern is that we just talked about on Senate Bill 209 was the possibility of invasive species coming in here. And at 15%, that still leaves 85% of the vessels that come in that you don't look at. And you said that you look at ones that would be extremely important where they come from. And could you tell me what that is? Where are those areas you look at that are highly questionable and so we have to look at these ships? You know where they are?
Chair Edwards, Vice Chair Olson, indeed. Our inspection program is based upon risk criteria. We don't just randomly select vessels. That risk criteria can include a variety of things. Appearance to have noncompliance with our management practices or lack of familiarity based upon their pre-arrival reporting form would be one. Previous noncompliance would be another. But in terms of their voyage characteristics, which I think is what you're getting at,
right, yeah.
Indeed, since we are most of our port activities and discharge activities activities happen in freshwater port environments. We were particularly concerned about vessels that had sourced their ballast water from another low salinity or freshwater port somewhere around the world. The organisms that had been taken on in ballasting of the vessel would be much more likely to survive upon release in the receiving environment here in Oregon. So that's why we identify them as a high risk.
In other words, if ships their beginning voyage comes from the Great Lakes, would they be put on your list as the one to look at?
Chair Edwards, Senator, or Vice Chair Olson, indeed. That would rank as a high criteria or a high concern for us.
Okay, and I apologize again. It always concerned me that we are so paranoid about this, and we know the financial damage that it's going to cause, but yet we only check 15% of the ships. I remember in 2011, I imagine Senator Przanski would agree with this, that we said that it's also a deterrent because they don't know who's going to get checked, so they have to follow the protocol. But, 2011, we had zebra mussels and aquatic species, quagga mussels, that were still entrapped in the Great Lakes, and in those years, they've moved over to Mississippi, now they're in Lake Mead. They're coming our way, and I just think that, personally, you need more money to do the job.
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, if I can respond. I think the concern is a great one, and you're right. We ideally would inspect more of these vessels and have a higher compliance rate, but if I can share with you how we arrived at the $88 fee, and Ryan can certainly jump in if he feels he needs to. We've worked real hard in this program to have a very good working relationship with the stakeholders, and they have been very – that includes the industry as well as other agencies in the environmental community, and particularly the industry gets a lot of credit for working very well with us to build this program and establish this program. I mean, really much before 2009, I don't think we had a program, and then we really got it going in 2011, so we've been building this program. And quite frankly, the handshake agreement that was arrived at in the task force report was the $88 fee that's in the Senate bill. And so we're trying to honor that. I think you're asking great, great questions about, is it enough? Do we have enough in enforcement and compliance? Do we have enough in place to protect our resources? But this is how we arrived at the $88 a number. It was an agreement with the stakeholders that they would contribute more, and then there would be an equal amount of general fund that would be contributed, and that's how we arrived at it. Mr. So we're just trying to honor that.
Mr. Chair, could I then ask?
Senator Przanski. Yeah,
what is the total dollar that we talk about then? How much is it?
Chair Edwards, Vice Chair Olson, the total dollar increase in revenue.
No. What does this fee generate? How much money does this fee generate?
We have about 1,500 arrivals a year at $70 per arrival. So per biennium, we're on the neighborhood of around $200,000.
Something along that line.
Yeah, I didn't actually have that written down. I should, but I can get you that information exactly, the precise numbers soon.
Thank you. Yeah.
Senator Przanski.
Well, it sounds like there's been some type of a understanding through the work group coming up with the number that's there, but maybe what would help us is to know what is, let's say, kind of the other charges that other ports or states are charging for the same type of service. Okay. And also, what I'm hearing is that we're talking about predominantly ships that are coming in with cargo. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about a lot of money that's coming in the sense of commerce. And it seems to me $88 isn't a whole lot of cost if we're actually as concerned as we are, and we want to be more aggressive. I'm not saying we're going to do it now, but I think this may be something the chair might want to entertain in the future to look at, because it's one thing to try to slow down. It's another thing to stop it.
Any other questions for the panel? Thank you both. Is there anybody else that would like to testify on Senate Bill 261? Okay, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 261. And finally, we are going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 20, which modifies applicability of minimum energy efficiency standards to certain products. So we will start the public hearing with Andy Ginsberg, the division administrator. Well, I'll let you read your title. I don't need to mess. I see a lot of commas and in there. So
initials.
Yeah.
Chair Edwards,
I'll let you introduce yourself, Andy.
I often can't say it myself. Chair Edwards, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, my name is Andy Ginsberg, and I am the Assistant Director for the Planning, Policy, and Technical Analysis Division at the Oregon Department of Energy. And I'm here today to provide information and support for Senate Bill 20, which was drafted at the request of appliance manufacturers to make some corrections to energy efficiency standards that were adopted in 2013. You'll notice that the printed bill is 17 pages long, but Senate Bill 20 makes changes to only 18 lines. Those few lines make three small but very important changes to the appliance standards that were adopted in 2013 as Senate Bill 692. ODO supports the changes because they will help the manufacturers and retailers comply with the standards. So I'll provide some very brief background on the appliance standards and then describe the corrections in Senate Bill 20. Appliances account for a significant and growing part of household and business electricity demand, and manufacturers are constantly striving to improve the energy efficiency of their products. So when enough manufacturers have energy efficient models, then appliance standards can be adopted for a category of appliances that would bring all the appliances in that category up to that level. Many of these standards are adopted at the federal level, but states can also band together to adopt standards and fill in gaps in the federal program by adopting standards at the state level. And the Oregon legislature has adopted standards three times in 2005, 2007, and 2013. So the standards that were adopted in 2013 covered televisions, battery chargers, and halogen lamps. Because appliances are sold across the country, there are two really important considerations when states adopt standards. First, the standards need to be the same from state to state so the manufacturers can comply with them with minimal cost. And second, there needs to be a transition period for retailers. Which brings me to the amendments proposed in Senate Bill 20. The bill includes three corrections to make it easier for the manufacturers and retailers to comply. And again, these were identified by manufacturers and their trade associations during our rulemaking process to implement the 2013 standards. The first change clarifies that the standards apply to appliances that were manufactured after the compliance date as opposed to sold after the compliance date. And that's intended to allow retailers to sell their existing stocks of compliances until they're gone. And you'll see this appears in multiple places in the bill, and that's just because it needs to cover all three types of appliance categories that were added in 2013. The second change corrects the standards for a subcategory of battery charger systems so that it matches the standards in other states. The correction is for an error in the description of the subcategory to clarify that it applies only to battery backups and uninterruptible power supplies for small battery charger systems, and also importantly to add a missing plus sign from the formula without which the standards would be much more stringent. So that plus sign is included in the standards in other states, and we need to make ours the same. The third change is it would repeal a redundant and conflicting provision for spare parts that was made for small battery charger systems. The 2013 legislation allowed the sale of spare parts for small battery charger systems that were sold after the new standards applied. But the bill did this in two separate provisions and with conflicting language, one of which has the incorrect compliance date. So Senate Bill 20 would repeal one of the two versions, one with the incorrect compliance date, and keep the other provision. So spare parts could still be sold. So in summary, Senate Bill 20 corrects errors in the 2013 appliance standards that were identified by manufacturers during ODO's rulemaking to implement Senate Bill 692. Manufacturers asked ODO to resolve these errors during the rulemaking process, but the corrections need to be made in statute. So we ask your support for Senate Bill 20 to make these corrections, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you for the presentation of what the bill does. Sounds relatively simple. Any questions?
I do have a question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So does the industry have any interest in us leaving these changes up to rulemaking? You know, it seems every time there's a change, it has to come before us. It's an arduous, well, maybe not as arduous as some of the bills we deal with, but, you know, I just wonder how necessary it is. You could have solved this in rulemaking if you had the statutory authority to do that.
Chair Edwards, Senator Dembro, I have heard some discussions in that area, but I haven't been personally involved, and I do believe that one of your other panelists will have comments specifically to that point.
Thank you.
I have a question. In looking through, and you were absolutely correct, because I read this thing again, and so there wasn't a lot of changes, but I was involved in the initial process here. But it concerned me. It didn't concern me. I was just curious. Where TVs must automatically enter television standby passive mode after a maximum of 15 minutes without video or audio input. Now, I'm sitting there watching TV. What does it do? Does the TV just automatically cut down on its own if I don't push a channel button or push a volume button? Do you know what that does?
Senator Edwards, Vice Chair Olson, if you were watching the television, it wouldn't turn off. This would be when it didn't receive any video input. So this is if it was not being used.
Your TV knows you're watching. It's a smart TV.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's just listening for the sound of your snore.
I heard that TVs in over in England can pick up what you say, and they transfer it over to a third party. I just heard that on the news. Anyhow, no, this is an interesting bill, and I agree with Senator Dembro. You know, couldn't this be something that would we don't have to deal with every month or every year?
Inherent powers, they call that.
No. Any other questions, Randy?
Thank you.
Next, we have signed up Max Mueller from the Citizens Utility Board.
Hello, my name is Max Mueller.
I knew you were going to say Mueller instead of Mueller. I've butchered everybody's name. Half of them I can't read, yeah, but yours I could. This is my bad.
You just take the country approach. Just say the first name. Yeah.
Okay.
It's German. Yeah, I don't know how to pronounce it, and I don't correct anyone. But my name is Max Mueller. I'm with the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon, or CUB. We work to represent residential ratepayers on issues relating to telecommunications, electricity, and natural gas. And Chair Edwards, Vice Chair Olson, and members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to testify. I basically got two points for you. The first one is that Senate Bill 20 is a good bill. CUB has been involved in the making of appliance energy efficiency standards for the last 10 years since they were first adopted in Illinois in 2005. The bill is a necessary fix for errors that were introduced in the drafting of the 2013 bill to create energy efficiency standards. We urge you to support that bill. But my second point has to do with the question that Senator Dembro asked. Why do we need to do this through the legislative process, and why not grant the Department of Energy the ability to do it through rulemaking? And we think that that's a very good question. And as you can see if you read Senate Bill 20, it's a pretty technical bill. It has 17 pages. A bunch of those pages are data tables. A single missing plus signed greatly strengthened on accident a standard. It's a pretty cumbersome process to move standards like this through the legislative process, and it's our belief that the technical staff at the Department of Energy are probably better equipped to handle the creation of standards like this. And we've, over the last 10 years of experience we've had working on these types of standards in Illinois, we've gotten a pretty good sense that the industry stakeholders who we've worked with on this issue agree with us, or are beginning to agree with us. And so as of about a few months ago, we started a discussion with them about how to create language that would grant the Department of Energy to create new energy efficiency standards by rule. Now, the Department of Energy can already, by rule, update energy efficiency standards for products if the legislature has previously created an energy efficiency standard for that product. It can already do that, but it cannot create new energy efficiency standards where they don't exist in current law. And so what we would like to do is propose a potential amendment to this bill that would grant the Department of Energy that authority. We're currently in discussion with all of the stakeholders in industry who have a stake in this issue, and are trying to arrive at an agreement with them, and we hope to bring that back to you for your consideration within the next week or so.
Thank you, and I appreciate you reaching out to other stakeholders. I know there's at least one association that is catching up on this issue, and I don't want to move it until I have input from them and how it would affect them, and get, you know, a more holistic understanding of the issue. But, and they have not signed up to testify today, but I know they're out there. So any other questions for Max? Thank you.
Thank you
for your testimony and perspective, and for working on the bill. Is there anybody else that would like to testify on this bill that has not signed up to do so? Okay. Seeing nobody, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 20. And anybody have anything for the good of the order? Okay, we are adjourned. Order. Okay, we are adjourned.